Your headlines for this hour: Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic will never stop supporting Palestinian resistance groups and the cause of Palestine. China strongly condemns the U.S. decision to provide Taiwan with military aid as a serious violation of One China principle. And Niger's military leaders temporarily suspend the activities of NGOs and international organizations in military operation zones, citing the country's security situation. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Iran's foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic's support for Palestinian people and the cause of liberating Palestine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a closed-door meeting with leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements in Lebanon. He assured them that Iran will not back down from its policy of supporting Palestinian resistance groups, especially in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian leaders, for their turn, described resistance as a strategic choice for Palestinian people. They added that anti-Israeli operations will continue across the West Bank. Amir Abdullahian is in Lebanon on the second leg of his regional tour, which has already taken him to Syria. Once in Beirut, he said Iran will continue supporting the Lebanese nation while calling for further expansion of cooperation between the two countries. On the occasion of Iran's Government Week, President Ebrahim Raisi has held a meeting with Iranian Sunni religious scholars from across the country. Addressing the event in Tehran, Raisi says a united Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance. Our correspondent Saman Kujuri reports.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies.
Iranian officials and the scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil industry is thriving in the face of U.S. sanctions. Now, global oil market observers say the country's crude production and exports have reached the highest level in the past 5 years. According to a Washington-based global energy consulting firm, Iran's oil output hit its highest since 2018 at 3.15 million barrels per day in August. The report said the country's crude and condensate exports also stood at just less than 2 million barrels per day. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally walked out of a deal it signed with Iran in 2015, known as the JCPOA, and reimposed sanctions on the country to curb its revenues. But Iran's oil industry has largely recovered since then. According to the consulting firm's report, the country is now on the path to recover its pre-sanctions oil production. Oil Minister Javad Oji said last month that Iran has secured $40 billion in energy deals in the past 20 months, including with Russia. On the 45th anniversary of the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr, a prominent Lebanese Shia cleric, the head of the Amal movement stressed that it was al-Sadr who called on unity and dialogue which is needed today to elect a president for the country. Here's more.
On the anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri reminded the nation of Sadr's legacy, stressing that the only way out of any crisis is unity among Lebanese people. Berri called on all parliamentary blocs to participate in a seven-day dialogue in Parliament, after which there would be open-ended sessions to elect a president.
Dear Lebanese, exactly 1 year has passed since my call on the parliamentary blocs on the need to realize a national agreement by electing a president who unites and does not divide, a president who is supported by the Christians, but also by Muslims, and who is before all this a nationalist. Such an accomplishment could assist Lebanon in exiting its economic crisis.
45 years after his disappearance, Imam al-Sadr is still seen as the main founder of resistance against the Israeli occupation, while also representing unity among the Lebanese people.
The legacy of Imam Musa Sadr did not only not die, but it overgrows all the periods of Lebanon. And every time we have a crisis, we remember that only his teachings and what he was calling for can represent the salvation for this country.
This is a very sad day for us. Had Imam Sadr been alive today, we would not have had all these problems we are seeing today. We would not have had these political, economic, or social problems. But we promised him that we will continue his path.
Imam Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal Hope Movement in 1974 and openly worked for the rights of the oppressed and the lower class in Lebanon.
Musa Sadr, the Lebanese Imam, represents all what does Lebanon represent. The unity, the ableness of living together, Muslims and Christians, the willingness not to surrender in front of evil. That's what Musa Sadr represents. They intended by kidnapping him to erase all his existence. His existence continued.
It's an opportunity for the Lebanese to remember what the Imam Sadr stands for as far as unity and peace and one country united for its own people.
The prominent Shiite cleric disappeared on August 31, 1978, during an official visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Lebanon still holds former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi responsible for his disappearance, along with two of his companions, while blaming the Libyan authorities for concealing details which could uncover the fate of Sadr.
45 years on, and the case of Musa Sadr's disappearance remains unclosed. The people of Lebanon unanimously believe that this is not a lost cause, for his legacy and the values of resistance and justice which he fought for have not died down. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
China has strongly condemned a U.S. decision to provide Taiwan with military aid under a program used for sovereign states. Beijing says the move is a serious violation of the One China principle to which Washington is committed.
By providing arms to China's Taiwan region through the so-called Foreign Military Financing Program that only applies to sovereign countries, the United States seriously violates the One China principle and the provisions of the three China-U.S. joint communiques, especially the 1982's communique, seriously violates international law and basic norms governing international relations, imperils China's sovereignty and security interests, endangers peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and sends a gravely wrong signal to the separatist forces in Taiwan. China strongly deplores and resolutely opposes the move.
Wang made the remarks in response to President Joe Biden administration's approval of the first ever provision of arms to Taiwan under the so-called Foreign Military Financing Program. U.S. media reports said the State Department intends to dedicate up to $80 million in military support to Taiwan under the program. Beijing has repeatedly warned against any official exchanges between Washington and Taipei, including provision of military assistance to the island. The top Chinese diplomat urged the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and stop arming Taiwan and fanning the flames of tensions in the region.
We urge the United States to earnestly abide by the One China principle and the provisions of the three China-U.S. joint communiques. Stop enhancing military contact with the Taiwan region or arming it in any pretext and in any form. Stop creating factors that could intensify tensions in the Taiwan Strait and stop conniving with and supporting the separatist attempts to seek Taiwan secession by force.
Wang also warned that no one should underestimate the Chinese people's strong determination, firm will, and strong ability to safeguard the country's national sovereignty and territorial integrity. Military leaders in Niger have temporarily suspended the activities and movements of NGOs, UN agencies, and other international organizations in military operation zones. Niger's Interior Ministry said the decision is linked to the current security situation in the West African country. Earlier on Thursday, the military government cancelled the visa of a French ambassador and instructed police to expel him. Meanwhile, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, reiterated its call for Niger's deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum, to be reinstated. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu, who heads ECOWAS, said 9 months would be enough for the transition back to democracy in Niger. Niger's military leaders say they want a maximum 3-year transition period to restore constitutional order. They accuse some Western countries, including France, of interfering in Niger's affairs. Kiev demands more F-16 fighter jets from EU countries as one of the bloc's members, Hungary, insists Ukraine's war against Russia cannot be won. The European Commission is proposing a 20 billion euro package of deadly weapons for Ukraine, while Budapest seeks to block the move. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, OK, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defence ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster. And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Meanwhile, the deputy head of Russia's Security Council has accused the United States of involvement in military-grade biological activities in Ukraine. Dmitry Medvedev said evidence about Washington's illegal biological activities has been found during Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. He said the Pentagon has set up dozens of specialized biolabs around Russia, warning that the world may see the emergence of new viruses of artificial origin. Medvedev also dismissed the U.S.'s claims that these biolabs are engaged in purely scientific work. He said Russia should be ready to counter external threats and prevent the spread of new infections. His warning came after earlier in August, U.S. presidential candidate Robert Kennedy Jr. said Washington has created biological laboratories in Ukraine. He added that the labs were part of the Pentagon's programs for developing biological weapons. Russia has warned that the West's approval of Ukraine's strikes on Crimea could set the stage for a disastrous war with the West. Moscow says any green light to Ukraine's attacks on Crimea gives it the right to take action against each and every NATO member. The stern warning has been issued by Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council. Meanwhile, the U.S. has announced a new $250 million military aid package for Ukraine, including air defense munitions, mine-clearing equipment and medical vehicles. The U.S. has provided Ukraine with more than $43 billion in military aid since the war with Russia began in February 2022. Moscow has warned time and again that Western arms supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war and add to the suffering of Ukrainian people. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
French authorities are to ban the wearing in school of abaya dresses worn by some Muslim women. Unlike headscarves banned in schools in 2004, the abaya, a garment worn to comply with Islamic beliefs on modest dress, had faced no outright ban until now. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, France will ban children from wearing the abaya, the loose-fitting, full-length robes worn by some Muslim women in state-run schools. Its education minister said recently ahead of schools returning after the summer holidays. France, which has enforced a strict ban on religious signs in state schools since 19th century laws, removed any traditional Catholic influence from public education, has struggled to update guidelines to deal with a growing Muslim minority. In 2004, France banned the wearing of signs or outfits by which students ostensibly show a religious affiliation in schools, like Islamic headscarves. In 2010, it passed a ban on full-face veils in public, angering many of its 5 million-strong Muslim community. Unlike headscarves, the abaya, a garment worn to comply with Islamic beliefs on modest dress, occupied a gray area and faced no outright ban until now. Defending secularism is a rallying cry in France that resonates across the political spectrum. From left-wingers upholding the liberal values of the Enlightenment to far-right voters seeking a bulwark against the growing role of Islam in French society. Education Minister Gabriel Attal said in an interview with TV channel TF1, "I have decided that the abaya could no longer be worn in schools." He claimed, "Secularism means the freedom to emancipate oneself through school." He continued describing the abaya as a religious gesture aimed at testing the resistance of the Republic towards the secular sanctuary that the school must constitute. He claimed, "When you walk into a classroom, you shouldn't be able to identify the pupil's religion just by looking at them." According to RT, schoolgirls in France will be banned from wearing the abaya, a full-length Islamic robe, in state schools starting from September. The education minister announced recently, arguing that the garment violates laws on secular education. The issue has long been debated in France amid claims that abayas worn in schools cause tensions between teachers and parents. A 2004 French law prohibits items of clothing that ostensibly show a religious affiliation in schools, such as Islamic headscarves. The ban has received criticisms even in France. Left-wing politicians have slammed the measure as Islamophobic. Clémentine Autain, a lawmaker from the La France Insoumis, or France Unbound party, called it unconstitutional and a sign of the obsessive rejection of Muslims. According to Anadolu News Agency, France is home to Europe's largest Muslim population. However, discrimination in the country is pushing many highly skilled Muslim professionals to seek better job opportunities in more tolerant societies accepting of their religious beliefs. A new study by the University of Lille, led by Professor Olivier Steves, revealed that highly educated Muslims are leaving France in large numbers for the UK, US, Canada, and Dubai. After surveying 1,074 Muslims who left the country, Steves argues that more than two-thirds of reported people, they moved to practice their religion more freely, while 70% said they left to avoid incidents of racism and discrimination. Steve suggested that Muslim professionals with in-demand skills are fed up with the way they are treated in the country. Steve pointed out, what's ironic is that France pays for these people's education, yet the country loses that highly skilled talent because of rampant institutional Islamophobia. Natasa Jetovic, finance project manager, moved to the UK from France in 2020 in the hope to be able to practice her religion more easily and being offered better job opportunities that match her skills. Her decision to move paid off, as since she moved to London, she has been promoted several times and is now earning double. She has experienced racist remarks at a leading French bank, where she was threatened by her manager to be fired for confronting and accusing her colleagues of discrimination. She said, "People would use racist terms and then I would ask them to stop, and from that moment onwards, nobody wanted to have lunches with me. Nobody wanted to talk to me for the next 6 months. I was just under boycotts." She is one of the many highly skilled Muslim professionals who do not feel welcome in France, and for that reason are taking their skills where they feel are more appreciated. Yasser Louati, a French political analyst and human rights advocate who is currently the head of the Committee for Justice and Liberties, told Anadolu News Agency that the lack of religious freedom has become a reason why Muslim professionals are leaving France. Louati argues that France loses highly skilled talent because of widespread institutional Islamophobia, and that the sole loser here is France. Those who leave France are essentially trained and educated in France through public funding, which means that there is no return on investments, and instead the rival economies are profiting from those with a rich background, both in terms of their education and culturally, he said. He added, "So one has to ask, how smart are our policymakers to let these people leave the country and work for economies in a globalized world where France is becoming a lame duck? When you discriminate, you push people toward exile, but I don't think leaving is the answer. It is also about confronting these policies." According to him, Muslims living in France are discriminated against in the terms of education, getting a job, purchasing a house, or even sometimes getting access to healthcare. The national policymakers would rather miss out on opportunities that allow people to be their equals. It's too bad for France. And honestly, I salute those countries and those companies that give a fair chance to these young men and women. Since 2015, the French government has adopted various laws that Muslims say restrict their religious freedoms, including a law that was passed in 2016 that prohibits the wearing of hijab at work. While in 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron and his centrist government passed legislation that puts imams under harsh government security. The government has also shut down mosques, Muslim-led groups, charities, and nonprofits without due process. Louati further pointed out that such policies have created a culture of hostility that, in turn, are responsible for the rise of Islamophobia in France. The negative Muslim portrayal in France media was intensified during 2022 presidential campaign by far-right candidates Marine Le Pen and Eric Zemmour, who dedicated much of their election campaign to the threats of Islam, as they claimed. A 2016 study revealed that a fifth of all instances of Islamophobia in France happens in the work environment. According to a 2021 government report, job applicants with a Muslim Arab-sounding names have a 32% less chance of being called in for an interview. Islamophobia in France is more prevalent because it is more visible. However, this does not mean that other Western governments are better, Louati said, adding, "If we take a look at what the UK is doing to their Muslims, or what Italy is doing, or what, for example, the US is doing, there is no big difference. However, even if their policies tend to be somehow radical, there are still more opportunities for Muslims there than in France. Muslims are fully aware that they cannot completely escape prejudice in the West. However, the discrimination at the workplace or in general is more visible and less sophisticated in France." Louati said, "Muslims are trying their very best. Muslims are here to stay, like it or not. Muslims have been here before you and they will be here after you."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters, mothers, ladies from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of your own program, Muslim Lady. So, this is IRIB English Radio, and once more, Asma is having the pleasure to be your host. And here with me, we have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
Alhamdulillah, I'm fine. How are you?
Thank you very much. Just like always, it's a pleasure for me to be here with you and with the Muslim ladies out there. Well, we have been talking about Muslim ladies for too long. We've been through different patterns of lifestyle. After we went through the study of the lifestyle of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha, and then we got to know too many things about how we should act in our families, how we should treat our families all in all. And then there were some specific things about the relationship of a man and a woman, the husband and the wife. And then comes this point where I guess it needs to be elaborated more and more, because the relationship between a wife and her husband is something that is so delicate and needs to be washed out every now and then. Yes, let's talk about this relationship more and more. I have heard it from a psychologist who said that people think that when they marry, they're actually, it's as if they're going to a journey which is going to be to a very good-natured place, and a place that is so beautiful, the weather is perfect and everything is just so cool. Sometimes there comes a coldness, a relationship, and who knows what is the cause of this coldness.
Yes, those who are not married don't know what is the cause of this coldness. And those psychologists like this person describes a married life do not know the factors behind it. In any relationship, it's very common for the initial warmth, you know, to fade away over time. So there can be several factors. It's not just one reason. There could be several reasons that contribute to a sense of coldness persisting in a relationship over time. Now, what are these reasons? So what could be, you know, what are these reasons? We stop making efforts. We make efforts in the beginning of a relationship. And then with the as time passes by, you have that partner now in your life, then you stop making any efforts. They kind of stop making those efforts. So efforts are needed all the time, not just at the initial state of
exactly.
your life. That's mm-hmm. the first. Then I think there's lack of communication. When we say lack of communication, it does not only mean that you do not communicate with each other, but sometimes you communicate negative. So I was saying when communication becomes, you know, sparse or negative, it can lead to misunderstandings, resentment, and that, you know, emotional distance. So failing to express your needs and your concerns effectively could result in the coldness that could persist over time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that you communicate effectively.
So let's go for a short break and then we'll be back to see the rest of the causes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So as for the Muslim ladies who are listening to this episode, we are talking about this thing, this fact that exists sometimes among the partners, which is the coldness and the distance that they feel among each other, because it is so important for us to know the causes. And then if we know the causes as the women, we can moderate the right. life of the entire family.
Things are completely different for men. Things are completely different. Expectations are different. And we got to be understanding each other's expectations. Our Prophet, peace be upon him and his purified family, said that, say to your wives in the Uhud book, you know, express your love to your wives.
Tell them that I love you.
Right. Because they want to hear that. But men, on the other hand, are a kind of opposite. They do not expect to be saying this all the time, you know. There was another, I would say, a series I was watching. So this man was expressing to his friend, like, if I respond to one of the messages of my wife, then she would continuously send me messages over time. So they kind of want us to understand once if they're busy or, you know, if they're into some work, they don't require that to expression all the time. But what men require is respect. They are very, very hungry for that respect. Like, women are hungry for love, but men are hungry for respect. Women ought to be obedient to their husbands. They're made like that. They are created that way.
It exists in their nature.
Yeah, it is in their nature. And if they persist to be like that, they're kind of doing justice or moving towards perfection. Well, I can elaborate on this in the future episodes, but right now I think it's important to know what we are discussing, the causes. Expectations are different, and it's really important to understand these expectations. Like, men has got to read about the women's psychology and women got to read about the men's psychology. It's not like what I want, he also wants the same thing, or what he wants, she also wants the same particular, you know, things. So it's unresolved issues. If conflicts and disagreements are not resolved properly, they can linger and create a sense of, you know, distance between the partners. Mm-hmm. And ignoring and kind of avoiding these important discussions can perpetuate the coldness in a relationship.
Exactly. So I would say the idea comes from understanding.
Right.
A woman and a man must have a perfect understanding of each other. And if not perfect, at least a moderate sort of understanding about your partner would help you know more about them and just act according to what is going to be more fruitful for them in the relationship. So if you know that as a partner in your relationship, you would just take care of every move you take.
Right.
Because then it's going to be more according to the points.
Right. But these expectations that we are talking about, they if they're not met, they do create a sense of disappointment or a kind of frustration or again a distance. But it's really important to, you know, to address these expectations and to
recognize them.
Yes,
yeah.
To modify them and to work on them so that coolness does not persist. It's really, really important to address these expectations.
Yeah. So there are, as we can see throughout the discussion, there are many factors and many causes for this distance and this coldness that might get in the relationship of a woman and a man in their life. So the thing that is very much important is to be aware of all these factors. So we're just counting them in order to give you some clues. And then you can just practice it in your own life. So right now, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back to see if there are some more of causes and factors to take care of. Welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Ladies. Yeah, this is your own program, and we're talking about the causes of distance and the coldness that gets in the life of partners, the wife and the husband in their home and in their families. So we said that there is this lack of understanding, lack of communication. When you stop doing efforts to attract the attention of your partner,
all these things. And unmet expectations.
Of course, and expectations that I have never talked about them. So how shall I just expect other people to just notice them? So it again comes out of understanding and maturity and knowledge, and all of these things together, I guess, are working for a better life together.
Right. And one of the very important things that we have to take into consideration when we have unmet expectations is that talk.
Again, lack of communication.
So, no, talk about your expectations. Say it. We must realize that the partner I'm living with, he does not get revelations about me.
Exactly.
What I'm feeling like or what I want. So sometimes we say, like, my partner does not understand me. Did you talk to him? Did you tell him, like, what do you want? Talk. Sometimes, you know, just saying simply things, look, I expect this thing from you. They understand.
You know, even if you go to the life of these people who wish to divorce, if you then talk to each one of them, then they would say things. And then when you go to the other person, you tell them that, okay, you have done this, you have done that. They would say, I have never thought about this before.
Right. So they are really unexpected or, you know, unrealistic, yeah. I would say, expectations. So even if you have unrealistic expectations, just talk about them. You know, this lack of communication or negatively or being not being able to effectively communicate with your partner does create a big distance and a big difference, you know, and a difference in terms of understanding. So there's another cause, I think, is neglecting the emotional connection. Why we do that? I think it happens when over time, couples may become preoccupied, you know, with other responsibilities, like such. Sometimes, like, we have work, we have children, and we neglect nurturing the emotional bond with our partner. Like, this ultimately leads to that gradual decline in a relationship. Even if you're occupied with your work, let me discuss this. I was just watching a video recently, and this man always interviews those who are in their 60s and 70s. And he was telling them, what is the biggest regret that you have in your life? And if you go back to your 20s, 30s, what would it be that you would not give more priority and you gave priority at that time? And all these people have just one common answer. I often watch these videos. Say that we gave more importance to work than our family. It's a big thing to understand. Sometimes you may not realize the importance of your family. You have work. Work is important, but it should not get dominant over your family. There should be a balance. You know, exactly. Excess of everything is
moderation bad. Is the key point to everything.
Right. So there's this, because of this busyness, there's another reason that comes into, you know, that comes there is the lack of quality time. When you have work, when you're preoccupied, your busy schedules and your demanding lifestyles, they limit the time spent together as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, insufficient quality time make the partners feel that they are disconnected. They're not connected to each other anymore. And unfortunately, we have these gadgets and devices today in our hands.
You are
in living under one roof, but at the same time, you're not living under one roof. Unfortunately, this has been done to us, or I must say, we were supposed to realize this, what we are doing with ourselves, and this should not, you know, penetrate through generations, then the things would go very, very first.
That's a very important thing, actually, you mentioned. Media is actually destroying everything in many families, because just as you said, these relationships are just a kind of a plant that needs watering. So if I neglect it, if I just ignore it, if I did not take care of it, then it would just fade away. And all that bloom, all that green-ish side of life would just get away from our life if we do not take care of it. Just as you said, we have to make a balance. We do not say that forget about your cell phones. You don't have to go in and surf in the net or things like that. The only thing is that you have to practice a moderation and try to have a balance. So we were talking about different factors and causes of the coldness and distance that gets between the relationship of a man and a woman in a married life. We went through some, the most important one of the factors that we mentioned were lack of communication, understanding, not understanding each other, expectations that we do not talk about them, and also stop
neglecting emotional connections.
Yeah, neglecting emotional connections and the efforts that you do not do anymore. Surfing in the net more than usual without purpose instead of just taking care of your family members, especially your partner, is going to lead to nowhere, and you have to take care of it, of course. I hope today's session was fruitful enough for you to enjoy it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, new research has shown that many people are currently facing worsening and in some cases catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays in healthcare. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A damning report warned thousands of patients in England are experiencing catastrophic health impact as a result of vital NHS appointments, procedures or operations being delayed or cancelled. A record 7.5 million people are waiting to start routine hospital treatment, the highest figure since records began back in 2007. About 385,000 people have now been waiting more than a year to start their NHS treatment. A devastating report by Healthwatch England, a watchdog, says the last-minute cancellations were causing patients to get even sicker and their mental health to deteriorate. It found some in severe pain have endured multiple cancellations and postponements. In 2022-2023, there were 77,266 last-minute cancelled operations for people waiting for pre-planned care in hospitals in England. Meanwhile, separate figures show that strikes over the past 8 months have led to 819,000 appointments, operations and procedures being postponed. The report published on Thursday, 27th of July, came a day after junior doctors in England announced a fresh round of strikes in August, which could lead to tens of thousands of more treatments being either delayed or cancelled. The British Medical Association, the BMA, said junior doctors in England would stage a four-day strike amid the continuing row with the government over pay. Thousands of new doctors will be urged to strike just over a week after starting work in England's hospitals. The strike will begin at 7 a.m. local time on 11th of August. A survey for the Health Watch report found that more than a third, or 39% of people who had an appointment called off this year, experienced cancellations or postponements two or more times. Approximately 1,084 adults in England who had an appointment cancelled in 2023 were polled by Yonder Data Solutions on behalf of Health Watch. They included people who faced postponements for pre-planned hospital care, hospital outpatient appointments, diagnosis scans or tests, and community health appointments. Nearly 1 in 5 or 18% said their appointments were cancelled at the last minute, either on the day or as they arrive for their appointment. About 66% said cancellations to care had an impact, reporting continuing pain, worsening symptoms, worsening mental health, and disrupted sleep, among other problems. Half, or 52%, said they had not been offered support to manage their medical condition during the new wait for care, and 79% said the National Health Service had offered them very little or no support with their mental health. Health Watch said some groups appeared to be disproportionately affected by the cancellations. They include unpaid carers, neurodivergent people, those on lower incomes, and people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Louise Ansari, the chief executive of Health Watch England, said the findings of our research show that many people are currently facing worsening and, in some cases, catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays to care. Louise Ansari continued, and addressing health inequalities continues to be a significant challenge for the National Health Service. She added, people who often face serious difficulties accessing specialist NHS care, such as unpaid carers, neurodivergent people and those on lower incomes, are also those who are suffering the most from ongoing cancellations. She added, if their symptoms worsen or their mental health deteriorates, this in turn puts extra pressure on health and care services. We urgently need to reduce the number of cancellations of appointments, especially last-minute cancellations, and greater action is needed to address widening health inequalities. She added, with industrial action in the National Health Service being one of the many factors impacting people's ability to access timely health care, we're also renewing our call for all parties to reach a resolution to mitigate the impact of strikes on patients. An NHS England spokesperson said strikes over the past 8 months had obviously had a significant impact, but claimed that staff were doing all they could to manage the disruption. National broadcaster ITV has also covered the same story. Radiographers at 37 National Health Service trusts in England are going on strike as the pay row with the government continues. Members of the Society of Radiographers have voted to reject the government's 5% pay award and called for talks to reopen after other public sector workers, including junior doctors, were offered more. The union said worrying numbers of staff are leaving the profession and not enough is being done to recruit more workers. The 48-hour strike will run from 8 a.m. local time on Tuesday, 1st of August, and will involve the 35 NHS trusts where members have a mandate to strike. These include the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital in London, University College London Hospitals, Liverpool University Hospitals, Nottingham University Hospitals, University Hospitals, Bristol and Western, and Sheffield's Teaching Hospitals. The Society of Radiographers said 9 out of 10 NHS patients are supported by radiographers who carry out X-rays, magnetic resonance imaging and CT scans, ultrasounds and breast screening, as well as radiotherapy for cancer patients. 1 million people are waiting for radiography. Dean Rogers, Executive Director of Industrial Strategy and Member Relations for the Society of Radiographers, said, "Voting for strike action was a difficult decision for our members, who care above all about the safety and well-being of their patients." Dean Rogers added, "We need to draw attention to the fact that many radiography professionals are feeling burnt out by low pay and increased working hours. They're leaving the National Health Service and they're not being replaced in adequate numbers." Dean Rogers added, "If the government wants to reduce NHS waiting lists and ensure that patients receive the treatment that they need when they need it, then it must urgently prioritise the recruitment and retention of radiography professionals, and that means talking to us about our pay and conditions." He said, "But they're refusing to talk to us even though our door is open. Our members deserve better. Our patients deserve better." Health and Social Care Secretary Steve Barclay said, "I want to see an end to disruptive strikes so the National Health Service can focus relentlessly on cutting waiting lists and delivering for patients." Dr. Win Diwakar, the National Health Service Medical Director for Secondary Care, said, "Figures show that impact of industrial action is having on patients and families, and the scale of disruption is likely to be even greater, with many services avoiding scheduling appointments for the strike days." Dr. Vin Diwakar said, "We have now seen 765,000 appointments needing to be rescheduled in the last 8 months because of strikes, and we are continuing to see a significant cumulative impact on National Health Service services, as well as our hardworking staff, as they do all they can to maintain safe patient services while tackling a record backlog."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.